to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Sunday, January 31st, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. I usually have a physical copy of the newspaper in front of me, but today it wasn't delivered, I can assume because of the snow. Be careful outside. So I'm going to be reading online, so forgive me if you hear some pokey-pokey around on the computer. The first story from the front page of the Gazette today: police video can be revealing, if public is allowed to see. Victims and reporters often have to go to court to gain access. This article is the first in an occasional series called In Focus about public access to police body camera and in-car camera video in Iowa by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette and Jared Strong of the Carroll Times-Herald. When an Iowa City police officer in 1996 accidentally shot and killed Eric Shaw, an artist working late in his father's office, Troy Kelsey wasn't the one who fired the gun, but knew police had made a terrible mistake when he saw blood flow from Shaw's body. Then the standard practice was for police departments to say no comment, said Kelsey, who after 27 years in the Iowa City Police Department is chief in University Heights, an enclave about 1,100 tucked within Iowa City. The PD and city, wrongly I think, were saying no comment, saying we screwed up wasn't going to change anything, but you're far better off saying I effed up royally. What can I do to deal with here? Then the standard practice was for police departments to say no comment. And now, what can I do in the future so this doesn't happen again? That experience made Kelsey strive to be as open as possible with the community, whether that means answering to a citizen's review board or releasing body camera video to the public. University Heights allows the public, including news reporters, to review video from police body cameras or in-car cameras, according to Iowa Code Chapter 22, Iowa's Open Records Law, with the permission of the chief or other authorized employee. But not every law enforcement agency across Iowa has the same policy. Some departments say police video should be released to the public only if it serves the interest of the agency. Others make no mention of the video as a public record, although according to Iowa law, it is. A decade after Iowa law enforcement agencies started using body cameras, Iowa has a widely divergent, unregulated system of rules and policies governing public access to a tool that many saw at the outset as a way of monitoring the conduct of police. Those disparities, found in a review of the policies of more than 200 agencies, can endanger the ability of everyday Iowans to answer questions about a family member's death at the hands of police or prove their innocence. For instance, Autumn Steele, a mother, was accidentally shot and killed in 2015 by a Burlington police officer while standing in her yard with one of her children. Video footage and other records released by order of a federal judge in a $2 million wrongful death lawsuit shows that what the family says was a police effort to cherry-pick information and witness statements to blunt police liability. Isaiah Hayes, a black man from Wisconsin, was fatally shot in 2018 by a Polk County sheriff's deputy. The office agreed in 2019 to release footage of the incident after a 15-month legal battle that cost taxpayers $120,000 to the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, which sued for release of records. Drew Edwards, 22, died in June 2019 after being tasered by Maquoketa police. The city didn't release the body camera video for months, even after the case was closed, citing protection of Edwards' privacy. But it was Edwards' family that wanted the video. The family eventually won a $4.5 million wrongful death settlement. Members of the Iowa Newspaper Association requested and received video policies from more than 200 law enforcement agencies for this report, which examines how police are using body cameras, how easy it is to access police video, and what ideas Iowans have for balancing privacy and accountability. Iowa law enforcement agencies started using cameras decades ago to record interactions with the public, but the use has evolved as technology has changed. When Carroll County Sheriff Ken Pingree was hired to be a deputy about 20 years ago in western Iowa, his patrol vehicle had a handheld camcorder mounted to its dash. He'd spent the first 10 years of his career without cameras, and it was sometimes difficult to remember to hit the record button for traffic stops. "When I first started, you had radio in your car, a radar unit, and a light bar controller," Pingree said. "Now there are printers, computers, cameras, all the other stuff." The Carroll County office later upgraded to new systems that included a metal storage box in the trunk that held a large tape recorder that started automatically when the red and blue lights were activated. Around that time in Iowa City, Alton Poole started fiddling with smaller cameras and tried to fix one to his University of Iowa police uniform. He had watched the dash cam recording of a state trooper in a scuffle with someone who tried to grab the trooper's gun. The problem with the video was that the reach for the gun happened outside of the camera's view. "Made it very easy for the public to jump to conclusions," Poole recalled. "After seeing that, I thought, why aren't we equipping our person with cameras? Poole said his department was the first in the state and one of the first in the nation to equip all of its officers with body-worn cameras, which happened in 2011. Of more than 200 agencies that responded to a request from Iowa media outlets, 90% now use body cameras. At $600 to $900 per camera, not to mention computer servers that can cost up to $500,000, cost is the limiting factor. These expensive tools have changed law enforcement, in part by deterring bad behavior on both sides of the camera, officers said. Poole likes to tell a story about asking a tailgater with an open container to empty his beer can. He asked, "What if I told you I was an attorney?" Poole recalled. I responded, "What if I told you I was recording this conversation for the judge?" Then the attorney poured out his drink. Appanoose County Sheriff Gary Anderson recently responded to a complaint against one of his officers by reviewing the body camera video and seeing that the complainant's third-hand account was mistaken. "If someone comes in here and wants to make a complaint, sit down here and watch the video with me," said Anderson, who has been at the Southern Iowa Agency for 34 years, 21 as sheriff. "I have nothing to hide." Body cameras also can help law enforcement supervisors detect and address misconduct among cops, said Sergeant Paul Parizek, public information officer for the Des Moines Police Department. In 2019, Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert fired Officer Lourdes Hodenfelt after her body camera video showed she lied about what happened during a traffic stop. Hodenfelt said a driver struck the officer's arm with her car's side mirror, but the video showed otherwise. Other examples have come up in hearings for officers seeking unemployment benefits after being fired. In 2019, Muscatine officer Benjamin Valera punched a handcuffed woman in the face, which knocked her to the ground, records show. The incident was captured on body camera video, then more widely circulated when the officer used his cell phone to make a recording of it, which he showed to other officers, emergency dispatchers, and his father. In a 2018 traffic stop, Adam Olson, a North Liberty police sergeant, failed to do a pat-down searches of three people suspected of shooting out the window of a vehicle, an administrative law judge found. A fellow officer who examined the video found Olson had committed more than a dozen policy violations during the stop. Body cam video and witness cell phone video have streamlined prosecution of criminal cases in Butler County, said Greg Levens, who recently retired after 32 years as county attorney. Video reduces the number of depositions before trial and answers questions for defense attorneys, he said. Now that body cameras are the norm, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and residents expect video of every police interaction, and they expect to be able to see everything like they would with a TV crew filming an episode of CSI. Jurors sit there and they watch a 30-minute television show and they expect lasers, they expect three-dimensional animation, they expect to watch the crime being recreated right in front of them, said Blackhawk County Sheriff Tony Thompson, who is president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association. There are cases where a prosecutor has been unwilling to prosecute the case because a body cam failed. Poole agreed, saying, "When you have a jury trial, one of the first things they ask is, where's the video? If there's no video, it didn't happen." Most agencies have written policies for officers using body-worn cameras and in-car cameras, although a dozen sheriffs and police chiefs noted their policies were outdated. Some still mentioned VHS tapes and said new versions are in the works. The word policy is used loosely by some agencies. The Ackley Police Department, a four-officer agency in Hardin County, has a two-paragraph memo from September 24, 2019 that includes the directive, "You are all professionals, so use your judgment when to use them." The policies run the gamut in amount of time to save the recordings, ranging from as little as a week to indefinitely. In Forest City, police video of a traffic stop in which there is no known arrest or other known reason to place the video into evidence may be deleted in 7 days. The Jones County Sheriff's Office policy says system files of non-evidentiary value are maintained for a minimum of 30 days and then classified as junk. But sometimes the public may not request a video of an interaction with police until later. If someone is pulled over for a traffic stop they feel is not proper, they've got a way to take a look at it, said Pete McRoberts, ACLU of Iowa Policy Director, about body camera footage. People can be honest but still wrong about what they recall. A body cam can break the tie. Video from body cams or in-car cameras often is useful for training and can help officers learn how to avoid acting on implicit bias, McRoberts said. Neither the State Sheriffs and Deputies Association nor the State Police Association provides policy recommendations, and the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy does not train recruits on how to use body cameras because of the different technologies. Nearly half the Iowa police policies reviewed identified video as a public record, either by mentioning Iowa Code Chapter 22 or stating media would be allowed to view video in at least some circumstances. But many chiefs and sheriffs have declined to release video, even in closed cases and even when the person shown in the video wants it to be made public. There shouldn't be any issue of when the videos should be released, said David O'Brien, a Cedar Rapids lawyer who represented the family of Autumn Steele, and more recently is using body camera video in a wrongful death lawsuit filed against the Burlington police who fatally shot Marquise Jones in 2017. How can you argue a body camera isn't immediate facts and circumstances? O'Brien asked, referring to language in the Chapter 22 Open Records Law that requires law enforcement officers to release the immediate facts and circumstances of criminal cases unless they could jeopardize an investigation or put people at risk. I think they should be released immediately. The law is pretty clear on it. Anderson from Appanoose County would like to have an open conversation with law enforcement, media, and privacy advocacy groups like the ACLU about when video is released. There needs to be some discussion made, but not demands from people, Anderson said. Do we need to re-abuse a female, a child, or whoever with a video that's going to be coming out? That has some long-term mental health ramifications. The ACLU seeks to protect the privacy of people inadvertently shown on camera or people in their own homes who aren't part of a police investigation. Once someone is part of a public investigation, arrest, or stop, that becomes a public record, McRoberts said. More than half of U.S. states have a law that addresses release of body cameras, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press reported. The law in Minnesota, where George Floyd was killed last spring in the custody of the Minneapolis Police Department, says recordings become public if they show the discharge of a firearm or use of force by an officer that results in substantial bodily harm. The other exception is if the person shown in the video wants it to be public. Missouri's law, passed in 2016, allows police videos to remain secret until after a criminal case is closed or if the video was shot in a private location. The exception to the last part is if the person shown in the recording wants the video. Junita Singh, legal fellow with the Reporters Committee, said states don't necessarily need a law on body cameras, but policymakers need to make sure laws reflect changing technology. As technology continues to evolve, we need to broaden the scope of what constitutes a public record to which the public and press are entitled, she said. In Iowa especially, the law has a presumption of disclosure. Laws governing body-worn cameras must strive to facilitate openness. Cedar Rapids lawyer Sam Jones wants law enforcement agencies to adapt their policies in recognition of maintaining court verdicts that require release of body camera video. It's a bit of a bruising process, but ultimately this litigation is healthy, he said. There will be greater certainty as a result of it. In 2019, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled a lower court was correct to balance confidentiality and transparency in a decision to release records, including video, of the 2016 shooting by a white police officer of Jeremy Mitchell, a black Cedar Rapids man paralyzed by the shots. Over in Polk County, a district court judge in October ordered Parizik to pay a $100 civil penalty and for the department to pay the legal costs of a civil rights advocate who sued Parizik for not releasing body camera video from officers involved in a contentious 2018 arrest. The public has an interest in how police respond to calls for service, Judge Paul Scott ruled October 6th. Police departments are funded by the public and answer to the public. O'Brien, the Cedar Rapids lawyer, thinks the fines should be higher, maybe $100 a day, or officers should face possible simple misdemeanor charges for not releasing video. This project is a collaboration of members of the Iowa Newspaper Association and includes reporting from 51 newspaper reporters across the state. Readers who have experienced difficulty in obtaining police video in Iowa can contact reporters at policevideotips@inanews.com. Also, from the front page of today's Gazette, more kids in class risks less distancing. School officials worry new law brings more exposure, by Grace King of the Gazette. With more students returning to classrooms next month under a new state law requiring that option, some Eastern Iowa school leaders say they are concerned about maintaining social distancing in class, raising fears of increased exposure to COVID-19. In the Iowa City Community School District, students have had the choice of either hybrid learning, attending in person in either A or B days and attending online on the opposite days, or online learning. But with less room for social distancing as more students return, Iowa City School Superintendent Matt Degner is among those concerned the district will see an influx in the number of both students and staff having to quarantine. On Friday, Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Senate File 160, which requires K-12 schools to offer a 100% in-person learning option by February 15th. Supporters of the measure cited concerns about students not in schools falling behind in their education, possible mental health issues for isolated students, and students at risk of abuse not being at school and under the supervision of mandatory reporters. Families will have 5 days to choose if they want their children enrolled in in-person learning or another option offered by their district, such as entirely online. We have some families excited about that option, happy to return to school 5 days a week in person, Degner said. The transmission of the novel coronavirus in schools is low if the proper precautions are taken, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported earlier this month. Precautions include wearing masks, social distancing at least 6 feet between people, and keep student cohorts small to limit the number of people who must quarantine if they are exposed. But some eastern Iowa school officials worry they won't be able to maintain proper social distancing, including in Iowa City, where Digner said the district will not be able to continue offering hybrid learning once it is also required to offer the in-person option. About 60% of the district's students currently are enrolled in hybrid learning, meaning that only 30% of the students overall are in-person learning any day of the week. The other 40% of the district students are enrolled in temporary virtual learning. Even in hybrid, there are classrooms struggling to distance 6 feet, school board member Janet Godwin said. Until teachers and school staff are vaccinated for COVID-19, Degner argued schools should not be required to offer in-person learning. To further complicate matters, Iowa City schools are less than a month away from the end of the trimester. To accommodate students in 100% in-person learning, the district will have to make changes to some class schedules. It's going to be a staffing challenge, Degner said. Cindy Garlock, a member of the Cedar Rapids Community School District School Board, said the law is a concern for the district. This board has been very open about their preference for local control, Garlock said last week in a board meeting. This requirement that schools offer 100% in-person takes local control away. In the Cedar Rapids District, pre-kindergarten through 8th grade students have had the option of either 100% in-person learning or temporary virtual learning since the start of the school year. But the high schools, Kennedy, Washington, Jefferson, and Metro, are in hybrid learning, with students attending in-person either on A or B days and learning online the opposite days. High school students also have the option of temporary virtual learning. It's only our high schools that would be affected by this, but with 1,800 students in a building, it's difficult to ensure social distancing and safety, Garlock said. Cedar Rapids Superintendent Noreen Bush was not available for comment. Lynmar Community School District pre-kindergarten through 6th grade students have been attending 100% in-person learning since January 8th. Last week, the Lynmar School Board made the decision to move 7th and 8th grade students to 100% in-person learning beginning February 2nd. Middle school students have been in hybrid learning all January. Lynmar High School had planned to keep hybrid learning to maintain social distancing. Local school boards and administrators know the space limitations of their facilities, Superintendent Shannon Bisgard said in an email. This discussion will certainly change once teachers, staffs, and students are able to be vaccinated. Iowa sees 1,060 new coronavirus cases. Iowa recorded 1,060 new positive cases for positive coronavirus cases as of 11 a.m. Saturday for the previous 24-hour period. With a 7-day average of 926, Saturday marked only the third time since early October when that figure was below 1,000, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data and as analyzed by the Gazette. Linn County was listed with 105 positive cases on the state's website. Johnson County had 24. Children under the age of 18 had 212 new cases. 4 new cases were reported for adults in education occupations. The top 10 counties for total positive cases are: number 1, Polk, 47,749. Number 2, Linn, 18,438. Number 3, Scott, 16,169. Number 4, Blackhawk, 14,337. Number 5, Woodbury, 13,238. Number 5, Johnson, 12,437. Number 6, Dubuque. Number 7, Dubuque, 11,800. Number 8, Pottawatomie, 9,303. Number 9, Dallas, 9,294. Number 10, Story, 8,994. 74 confirmed deaths related to the virus were recorded, with almost 64% of those, 47 people, above the age of 80. 2 of the deaths reported Saturday morning were in Linn County, 1 was in Johnson County, and 1 in Benton County. A total of 4,651 Iowans have died from COVID-19 since March of this past year. There were 376 people in hospitals for the virus, with 84 in intensive care units and 31 on ventilators. The state listed 57 current outbreaks at long-term care facilities, with 29 additional deaths related to COVID-19. Thus far, 1,932 deaths have been recorded for long-term care facilities. The Gardens of Cedar Rapids in Linn County was listed on the state's website Saturday with 25 positive cases and 21 recoveries. Johnson County was noted for Briarwood Health Care Center with 18 positive cases and 10 recoveries, and Lantern Park Specialty Care with 40 positive cases and 10 recoveries. According to the state's website Saturday morning, 236,608 vaccine doses have been administered to Iowa residents, with 58,183 individuals having received their second dose. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention listed 27.9 million vaccines as having been administered nationwide. The Iowa Department of Public Health said on Friday some 64,000 doses of vaccine that have been allocated for the Long-Term Care Pharmacy Partnership Program will be redistributed to priority populations, residents 65 years and older. Frontline healthcare workers and residents and staff at long-term care facilities are able to get vaccines now. Iowans 65 and older have moved up in line for vaccination starting in February, but other groups have to wait. Officials warn there are more Iowans eligible than there are vaccine doses available, so it may take weeks for vaccinations to actually begin. Here's a look according to Iowa guidelines. For Iowans under 65, you may qualify for a vaccine starting in February if you meet criteria in the groups below. The tiers are ranked in order of vaccination priority. Tier 1, first responders such as firefighters, police officers, and child welfare, social workers, school staff, and early childhood education and child care workers. Tier 2, food, agriculture, distribution, and manufacturing workers who work or live or in congregate settings that don't allow for social distancing, people with disabilities living in home settings, and their caregivers. Tier 3, staff and residents in congregate living settings that include shelters, behavioral health treatment centers, sober living homes, and detention centers, but not college dorms, government officials and staff working at the Iowa Capitol during the Iowa legislative session. Tier 4, inspectors responsible for hospital, long-term care, and child safety. Tier 5, correctional facility staff and incarcerated people in state and local facilities. Those who don't meet those criteria will have to wait. The state will announce other stages and occupational categories as they qualify. Turning to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial for today is entitled Doubling Down on Failure. The Iowa GOP's crusade against family planning is backfiring. Continuing down their list of poor priorities during a deadly infectious disease pandemic, Iowa Republicans are offering a radical measure to limit abortion access. The proposal will declare that the Iowa Constitution, quote, does not recognize, grant, or secure a right to abortion or require the public funding of abortion, end quote. If it earns final approval, it would give future legislators the ability to pass extreme abortion restrictions and leave the courts with little ability to intervene. This is in direct response to recent court decisions that anti-abortion advocates don't like. Under total Republican control of state government the past 4 years, policymakers have repeatedly infringed on reproductive rights, setting up expensive legal battles, and getting rebuked by judges. The GOP campaign against family planning appears to be backfiring. After a decades-long decline in the number of abortions performed in our state, the figure jumped up by 25% between 2018 and 2019, the Associated Press reported last year. There's a clear line between the increase in abortions and Iowa's decision in 2017 to turn down federal family planning funds. State officials set up their own program, allowing them to exclude organizations that also perform abortions, such as Planned Parenthood. The state published a lengthy list of eligible providers, but it turned out many were not actually set up to provide those services, as former Gazette columnist Linda Waddington reported at the time. An assistant in a neurologist's office laughed when I asked if I could make an appointment for a pap smear. One of the listed phone numbers is a direct line to an operating room at St. Luke's Hospital, Waddington wrote in 2018. All that has made it harder for low-income Iowans to get birth control counseling, contraception, testing, and exams. We know these very same services are associated with lower abortion rates. Instead of making them more accessible, legislative Republicans are determined to restrict abortion rights. An amendment to nix abortion rights in the Iowa Constitution passed the Iowa Senate last year, but not the full House. Republicans have since increased their majorities. Reintroduced this year, it has already been approved by the full House and Senate. Action is expected next week. In Iowa, constitutional amendments must get approval in two separate general assemblies and a statewide ballot measure. Lawmakers would need to pass it in both chambers this year or next, again in 2023 or 2024, and then turn it over to voters. Iowans are narrowly divided on abortion rights. While 48% believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and 45% believe abortion should be illegal in all or most cases, according to a Des Moines Register-MediaCom Iowa poll released last year, support for an anti-abortion constitutional amendment is paltry. Just 33% support it, while 54% oppose. A statewide vote on abortion rights, which could come as early as 2023 or could be scheduled to coincide with the 2024 general election, would put Iowa in the middle of a contentious culture war debate. It would invite vast sums of outside political spending on both sides of the issue, potentially drowning out the view of Iowans. What's more, Republicans are pushing forward the amendment at a time when public input in the legislative process is limited. Many Iowans will choose not to visit the statehouse this year because legislative leaders haven't taken basic steps to protect against the spread of COVID-19. So far this legislative session, Republicans have offered little action on the issues that might unite Iowans, like getting the pandemic under control and bolstering economic opportunity. Instead, they're taking up a divisive agenda that threatens our individual rights. Today's political cartoon is from Mike Lukovich, a syndicated cartoonist. It pictures two elephants in workmen's clothes standing in front of the congressional chambers, congressional building, and they are holding buckets that say on them, whitewash. One of the elephants remarks to the other elephant, good as new. The first community letter is from Jim Berger Jr. of Cedar Rapids. More political dialogue is needed in Iowa. I have suggested and invited some of our state representatives via their websites to have town hall meetings to discuss several topics. However, I have heard crickets on their end. I would love to see my U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson have a town hall meeting in Cedar Rapids. I would also love to invite and encourage Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley to come to Cedar Rapids for a town hall meeting. I would request this not be a quick meeting, but one with open dialogue and specific answers to questions many of us had regarding decisions you are making, allegedly, on behalf of Iowans. That was from Jim Berger Jr. of Cedar Rapids. Next, Teresa Grant of Grinnell writes, "Our public schools are in danger. As a former educator, I am very concerned about our public schools due to the lack of sufficient funding provided by the state. Teachers are dealing with higher numbers in their classrooms, an increased workload, and smaller increases in salaries. Now with the pandemic, teachers are working longer hours to create lessons to meet the needs of in-person and virtual learners. They are completely exhausted, and many are now deciding to retire early. There are younger teachers who are now preparing to leave the teaching profession. With this crisis in our public education, the Iowa Senate is proposing taking funding away from our public schools to provide vouchers for private education. Instead of helping struggling schools to perform better and help teachers, our governor and legislators want to further punish the public school system in Iowa. We used to have one of the best educational systems in Iowa, but these bills will further erode our stellar reputation of a good quality education for all students in Iowa." That was from Teresa Grant of Grinnell. Next, Kamyar Enshian of Cedar Falls writes, "Golden Rule is washed away with Lost Prairie. Right after the floods of 2008, I was serving on the Cedar Falls City Council then, a large group of residents and public officials up and down the Cedar River watershed came together and committed to work hard to reestablish natural areas and processes that reduced flooding intensity and protected all of us. That group has been busy ever since and has gotten a lot done. We now know that if, over the last many decades, we had not impaired the floodplains of the Cedar River, if we had given more room to the river, if we had restored more water-holding capacity to the upstream soils, the peak flood elevation in downtown Cedar Rapids in 2008 would have been much lower, causing far less damage. I was astonished to learn that plans are underway to destroy the 27-acre prairie that was established along the river just south of downtown Cedar Rapids. That prairie is a giant sponge and benefits people locally and Iowans downstream. My friend Wendell Berry says that the golden rule applied to our behavior in a watershed would be, do unto people downstream as you would have people upstream do unto you. We need to restore as many natural areas all along the Cedar River watershed as the number of sandbags used in 2008. Destroying a 27-acre prairie is not wise. I strongly urge the residents of Cedar Rapids to ask their city council to consider changing their plans." That was from Kamyar Enshian of Cedar Falls. Next, Paul Deaton of Solon writes, "Count the 22 votes in Iowa's 2nd District. The Federal Contested Election Act of 1969 is the statutory basis designed by the Congress to resolve election disputes like the one between Rita Hart and Marionette Miller Meeks in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. With a 6-vote margin, it was as close as it could get. The Hart campaign identified 22 legally cast votes that were not counted. Miller Meeks has not contested them. They should be counted. I read Miller Meek's response to the appeal and it argued, in part, Hart did not exhaust all state-level venues for her contest. No, she didn't. That is not relevant. There is no legal requirement under federal law to exhaust other remedies in this election dispute. If anything, the House Administration Committee is exactly where this dispute should be decided, as the Congress designed the statute specifically for this type of case. I would understand if Miller Meek's contended the 22 ballots identified for Hart were in some manner suspect. She didn't. Whatever the Congress decides on the rest of it, those 22 votes should be counted." That was Paul Deaton of Solon. Next, Bob Gilchrist of Springville writes, "Republicans pursuing the wrong priorities. As regular Iowans are dealing with COVID-19, sickness and death, loss of a job, and small businesses closing their doors, Republican leaders in the Iowa legislature are working on a death penalty bill, a bill to allow guns in schools and daycare centers, and will fill their extra time taking money from public schools for vouchers. Wake up, Republican leaders. Deal with Iowans' problems, not your personal hot-button issues. Look outside at hurting Iowans. It is also interesting that they won't wear masks, so many Iowans fear going to the Capitol to lobby. Good job pushing your personal issues while keeping the public away." That was Bob Gilchrist of Springville. And finally, Ruth D. Spiker of Iowa City writes, "Iowa senators should send a clear message. My brother, a U.S. Army veteran, died recently. He was laid to rest with full military honors, including a 21-gun salute. That our former president would bestow the same honor upon himself is not only inappropriate, it is despicable. Our former president is not only a draft dodger, but a pathological liar and an instigator of violence against democracy. He has accepted no responsibility nor expressed remorse for any of his actions or inaction. Instead, he pats himself on the back. Anyone who has served in the military, including Senator Joni Ernst, should be appalled by this behavior. I implore her and Senator Chuck Grassley to vote to convict the impeached president. He should never again be allowed to run for office. Send a clear message. Impeachment is not divisive. It is preventative. The only military honor deserving of our former president is the sound of taps playing on his political career. That was Ruth D. Spiker of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 31st, 2021. On the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn now to the obituaries. The other notices, Charlene Schertz, known as Charlie, age 68, died Wednesday, January 27th. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service is serving the family. Margaret Gleason, known as Peggy, age 88, died Tuesday, January 26th, TN Funeral Home, handling arrangements. Gail Leroy Yerkes, 80, of Waterloo, died Wednesday, January 27th, and Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton is handling arrangements. George Marshall of Anamosa, age 81, died Thursday, January 28th, at his home. In accordance with his wishes, there will be no services. Edwin Hart, age 79, of Viola, died Thursday, January 28th, at the Jones Regional Medical Center following an extended illness. Edwin donated his body to the University of Iowa Department of Anatomy in Iowa City. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, February 1st, at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. Interment will be a later date in the Wilcox Cemetery in rural Anamosa. Masks must be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times to enter the funeral home. Social distancing needs to be practiced as well. John C. Schmidt, 82, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, January 26th. A private family funeral service will take place on Saturday, February 6th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the service may be accessed on the funeral home website and the obituary for John under the video tab. On a personal note, this is not the same John Schmidt who often would read the paper with me on Sunday mornings. He is still alive. This is a different John Schmidt of Cedar Rapids. Dennis Shabetka, age 79, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, January 27th, from pancreatic cancer in his home. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, February 1st, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Private family burial with military rites will be in the Shoeyville Cemetery. The family asks that everyone attending wear a mask and practice social distancing. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of arrangements. Mary Lou Crow, born Mary Lou Cover of Riverside, California, who was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away. She will be interred in the wall with Clifford, her husband, at Riverside National Cemetery in Riverside, California. Terry Leah Smith, born Terry Leah West, age 64, of Cedar Rapids, died at her home on Sunday, January 24th. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday, February 1st, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 7:30 p.m. at the funeral home. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Lloyd Hruby, age 88, a lifelong resident of rural Oxford, died Thursday, January 28th. He passed peacefully at home with his wife, Marie, at his side. A private mass due to COVID-19 will be held for family and close friends at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, February 2nd. Gary W. Bai, 86, of Cedar Rapids, died on Monday, January 25th at Manor Care in Cedar Rapids. Private graveside services will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, February 5th at Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted the family. Don Edward Gottschalk, 77, of Cedar Falls, passed away peacefully on Thursday, January 21st, surrounded by loving family after fighting a 20-year-long and courageous battle with cancer. He was born at the family farm in Elkader on September 26, 1943. The family will be holding a private memorial service, but you are invited to view it virtually at facebook.com/CedarHeightsPRES. And William Hughes Carmichael, known as Bill, of Okoboji, age 84, passed away peacefully on Thursday, January 21st. And memories may be expressed to the family at www.CaminoDelSol.com. Turning to the sports page, under Iowa Wrestling, youngest brands building his own brand. Not content trading on proud wrestling name, but carving his own path, by KJ Pilcher of the Gazette. Nelson Brands wasn't groomed to be a wrestler. Even though he seemed predestined for the mat with potential pumping through his veins, he had to discover the passion for it naturally before following the footsteps of his NCAA and world champion father and uncle, Terry and Tom Brands. Terry was hands-off, Iowa head coach Tom Brands said of his brother and the Hawkeyes associate head coach. That surprises people, but it doesn't surprise me. We want individuals in our program, and Nelson is his own man. He was raised like you raise your kids. He wasn't raised to be a champion on the mat. He was raised to be a champion in life, and he chose wrestling. Nelson has carved his own niche in the sport and for the top-ranked Hawkeyes. He has stepped in the 184-pound starting spot this season, ascending to sixth in the national rankings, entering today's duel against number 9 Illinois at Carver Hawkeye Arena. I truly believe there is no better place that I could be than Carver Hawkeye Arena with Tom and Terry, Nelson said. I say Tom and Terry instead of my dad and uncle because when I'm in Carver Hawkeye Arena, I refer to them as Tom and Terry. As soon as I leave here, I'm back to Dad and Tom. I definitely enjoy wrestling here. Nelson didn't compete in his first tournament until sixth grade, loading into the family SUV and traveling to Williamsburg with Terry. He may have started later than most on his level, but Tom Brands noticed the makings of a wrestler. Like the time he watched Nelson react to getting hit in the face, which caused a bloody nose. He got thumped pretty good, but I just remember him. He was sitting out away, hanging his nose away from his chest so it wouldn't bleed on his leg or chest or whatever, Tom said. He was kind of laughing or giggling. I saw it. He got hit hard. He was just kind of laughing like, how do I stop the bleeding? That is a pretty good sign that you've got somebody that can deal with a little owie or a little bit of discomfort or pain. Hall of Fame coach Mark Ryland coached Nelson at Iowa City West and was a teammate of Tom and Terry. He noted that the younger Brands is not a carbon copy of the other two. He's a completely different animal than his dad and uncle, Ryland told the Gazette before coaching him to the second of three state titles with the Trojans. He's got a lot more jokes and relaxation to him than they did. There are a lot of different ways to skin a cat, as Terry would say. Nelson acknowledges he doesn't have the same temperament. He said he is more chill with wrestling and in life. He certainly has some of the intense components, including the family's famous competitive streak. I want to be first, Nelson said. I want to be first in pretty much everything I do. I've had instances in my life growing up where I tried to get to the first in line in third grade, and I got in trouble for that. Things like that are definitely similar to Tom and Terry. Nelson is much bigger than his dad, who was a 2-time NCAA champion and 3-time national finalist at 126 for Iowa, a 2-time world champion at 125.5, and was a 2000 Olympic bronze medalist at 127¾. Nelson started his high school career at 126, growing to 138, 152, and 160 by the time he graduated. He recalled the time he wrestled a full-length match with Terry, who won 11-8. Nelson said he'd have a better outcome now if he would accept when his dad jokingly offers a rematch. It was not fun, Nelson said. I don't think it would be very fun for him if we wrestled right now, which I'm sure we won't, but if he wants to and he doesn't really care about his lower back, we might go. Being a Brands has probably made him a marked man in wrestling circles. Nelson's probably had a target affixed to his back by people that would consider that a marquee victory in name alone, but he has taken it in stride. I think that he's put that in perspective since day one, Tom said. Brands, 2-0, is expected to face number 11, Zach Braunagle, 2-2. The two met last year at the Midlands Championship with Braunagle winning, 3-2. The match promises a style that Brands prefers. They're bashy guys, Nelson said. They're going to come at you and headbutt you and swing arms, and I like that. I like that feeling. I like getting hit a few times. I'm going to have to be super stingy with him and frustrate him to get him out of positions to get to mine. And under the heading, Iowans in the NFL, Eastern Iowa to the Super Bowl. Mount Vernon rejoicing in Werf's ride to the NFL Summit in Year One, by Leah Van. The Gazette's Sarah Werf's, by Leah Van of the Gazette. Sarah Werf's has never flown so much in her life. But that changed this NFL season. She followed her son, Tristan Wirfs, that's W-I-R-F-S, a Tampa Bay Buccaneers rookie, across the country. She'd flown exactly 3 times before this season, once for the Outback Bowl in Tampa Bay when Tristan played at the University of Iowa, once for the Holiday Bowl in San Diego, once when she was 17 years old traveling to Cancun for a school trip. She said her favorite trip so far this season was Denver because walking out of Empower Field at Mile High, she could explore the city on foot against the backdrop of the Rocky Mountains. At Raymond James Stadium in Tampa Bay, she gets the star treatment at the Hyundai Club, which is nice too. The iconic Lambeau Field last week, while cold, was special in itself, watching her son play in the NFC Championship game in advance to the NFL's most coveted stage. She'd sit nosebleed seats any day for that, where she can see the whole field like a true Midwesterner. She embraces the cold, but her throat got a little sore from screaming in it. Up until this year, I had never been to an NFL game, Sarah said. It's usually beforehand, and especially after Tristan's game, that I'm kind of shook with awe a little bit. The fact that that's my son out there, and he's blocking for Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski, it's really hard to wrap your head around. The surreal feeling of watching Tristan compete at the highest level reverberates through the town of Mount Vernon, where the Buccaneers have an unsuspecting following in the heart of Eastern Iowa just because of Tristan. "I love Mount Vernon. I'm super proud to be from that town," Tristan said over the phone from Tampa on Thursday. "I love the entire state of Iowa. Hopefully I have the whole state behind me." He probably does. This year, people sent pictures to Sarah at the AAU state wrestling meet of kids wearing his jersey. Less than a year ago, a parade of cars drove by the Wirfs home during the NFL draft, honking in celebration of the town's NFL acquisition. Now he's going to the Super Bowl. "That's one of those things you have in the back of your mind," Mount Vernon High School football coach Lance Peterson said. "I was talking to my wife. Tristan was originally slated to be the number 4 pick in the draft. As we were watching, I was upset and sad he wasn't picked at the number 4 spot, and the next tackle went by. I said that if he got picked by the Bucks, he could be going to the Super Bowl." Aaron Truitt, assistant wrestling coach at Mount Vernon, had to buy more Tampa Bay gear for his family last week following the Bucks' victory over the Packers. "2 weeks ago, I was wearing a Tampa Bay shirt, and a little kindergarten boy walked by and said, 'Hey, I like the Bucks too,'" Truitt said. "If it was easier to find Tampa Bay gear, I bet we'd see a lot more of it." It's Tristan's humbleness that's infectious and true to his small-town identity, and he's collected fans along the way as a result. Truitt said when Tristan calls, he'll always say hello to his two daughters, Olivia and Elena. As an elementary aide in high school, Tristan would take a third-grade girl with special needs out of her wheelchair, set her on a mat, and roll the ball back and forth with her. He thinks it's important for young kids to have sports figures to look up to. And while Tristan always has been known for his victories, it was the losses where Truitt saw his greatest moments. "We knew he was going to be special his freshman year," Truitt said. "We talked to him and said, 'We'll have you wrestle in dual meets, and on the weekend, you can wrestle JV if you want.' The first weekend, we gave him the option, but even though he wasn't successful, he wanted to be around a varsity team, so he was varsity the whole year. He was like 10 and 27. Here's a kid that wasn't used to losing and had been successful his whole life up to that point." Truitt said he and Tristan talked a few times over the phone this season, but Truitt sent him a text every week reminding him all he has control over was his attitude and effort, a motto he shares with all of his wrestlers. What's special about the Super Bowl, though, is Kaylia, Tristan's sister, also will be there. As a student at Wartburg College in Waverly, she's only been able to fit one other game into her schedule. Ironically, it was the one where the Buccaneers lost to the Chiefs on November 29th. She's liked the NFL game experience more than when Tristan played at Iowa, but for a reason a lot of people wouldn't. "I am not a crowd person. When there are crowds, it's just so stressful, Kaylia said. "It was a lot more relaxed, a welcome change. The lines aren't long. It's nice and spread out from everyone. You can see the game all the time." The Outback Bowl was at Raymond James Stadium, so Kaylia said seeing her brother play as the home team instead of being that kid from Iowa was crazy. But that kid from Iowa recognizes where he came from. "I think I just want to tell them all I love them and a huge thank you for all the support they've given me," Tristan said. It doesn't go unnoticed. "I'll be back soon, hopefully, with a big fat ring on my finger." From the Iowa Today page, peace of mind for immigrant parents in CR apartments a ride to school brings. Peace of mind. And this story is accompanied by a photograph of a young person waiting for a van. There's a large red van that says Refugee and Immigrant Services on its side, picking up the child. And this story is written by Allison Gowans of the Gazette. It was about 15 degrees Wednesday morning, and Wachowosemi Ale was watching younger brother Abraham Irizok climb into a red van that had just pulled up outside their southwest side apartment to give the fourth grader a ride to Hoover Elementary. The school is less than a mile away, but Ale was grateful his little brother wouldn't have to walk there in the cold. Ale's leg was in a cast. He recently broke it in a car crash, so he couldn't take his brother to school. And his father and sister were at work, so the van ride was a huge help, he said. It's a new service from the Refugee and Immigrant Association, a nonprofit made up primarily of immigrants from Central and East Africa, serving community members in Johnson and Linn counties. The organization bought the van and started offering rides to school last week for children in a couple of Southwest Cedar Rapids apartment buildings with large immigrant populations. The effort grew from requests from the community. After the August 10th derecho, the organization was active in some of the apartments that were hard hit by the storm, checking on residents and passing out charcoal for grills while the power was out and grocery store gift cards to help replace spoiled food. Organizers wanted to know what else they could do to help. One need that was quickly identified was transportation. Many residents had lost their cars to tree damage and had only liability insurance, so couldn't easily repair or replace them. Other parents worked during the start or end of the school day, but worried about their children walking to and from school alone. We asked, "What do you need for sustainability of the community?" Board member Belton Wendo said. One community member came with the idea and said he had been knocking on doors at the schools and at other organizations to find transportation for kids who walk to school. The children they are helping live less than 2 miles from the schools and thus do not qualify for district busing under Iowa code, which says elementary and middle school students must live more than 2 miles from their school and high school students must live more than 3 miles away. The man who proposed the idea was Felician Nikoliukie, who lives at the Glenbrook Apartments, with Refugee and Immigrant Association member Immaculee Mukahirigo translating for him. He said his own children are too old to need the service, but he wanted to help all the children he saw walking every day. The route from the apartment complex to Hoover goes along busy Wiley Boulevard Southwest. When you get outside, you are very, very cold, he said. Even if you have a coat, walking is hard in winter. I have seen children walking and shivering. I felt bad I could not do anything about that. I was feeling bad in my heart. Right now, the association has one van, though Window said it hopes to purchase a second, as the first van is already almost full each day, taking kids to Hoover and Cleveland elementaries. Word of the service has spread by word of mouth through the parents who live in the buildings. Parents paid $20 each to contribute to the fundraising for the van, and organization board members raised the rest of the money from their own pockets and from other community members. Now we are thinking about how to get other community members to be involved, Window said. We're welcoming everybody to come and volunteer for driving, taking kids to school and after school. Window said they have formed a parents' committee from the apartment complexes they've been working with to collect input from residents and pass it on to the organization's board. He said they want their support to reflect what the community says it needs rather than make assumptions. Farley, watching his brother get a ride to school, this fit the bill. It's the little supportive things. It's perfect, he said. Also from Iowa Today, new Lynn supervisor hopes to be a rural voice. Former Representative Zumbach is board's sole Republican, by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette. Louis Zumbach said he wanted to run for the Lynn County Board of Supervisors years ago, but was persuaded to try for a seat in the Iowa House instead. The House was never on my radar, he said, but one day I was pushing snow and my phone rang. It was Speaker Linda Upmeyer, and she asked me to run for District 95. Zumbach went on to serve 2 terms in the House from 2017 to 2019 as the Republican representative for District 95, which includes his home in Coggin, before running last year for county supervisor. He has also served on the county's Planning and Zoning Board, including as its chair, and was president of the County Fair Board. I just feel we weren't given much attention anymore out here in the rural area, and I wanted to see if I could change that, said Zumbach, who won the open seat and now is the newest of the 3-member Board of Supervisors. Oftentimes, when I get calls as a representative, it was more local. I enjoy fixing things for people, and it was more local in the end. Supervisors are more adept with that. A Coggin native and fifth-generation farmer, Zumbach plans to balance working the farm with being the District 3 supervisor, which the county considers a full-time job. I'm pretty much working all the time, Zumbach said. Farming is my full-time job, not only as a business, but as a livelihood. Zumbach, the sole Republican on the board, joined Democrats Ben Rogers and Stacey Walker when he was sworn in January 4th. His District 3 seat includes Marion, Ely, Lisbon, Mount Vernon, Springville, Bertram, Wabeek, Whittier, Prairieburg, Coggin, Central City, Alburnett, Center Point, Walker, Troy Mills, Fairfax, and Walford, plus the unincorporated rural areas of the county. He succeeds now former supervisor Brent Olson, who retired from the seat last year. Zumbach won the seat against longtime deputy sheriff and Center Point City Council member John Stuhlke. Zumbach received 23,159 votes to Stuhlke's 20,978. Zumbach said he would like the board to put more emphasis on the rural areas of the county. I want the people to know they can call somebody that can make a difference and we'll get back in touch with some kind of a result, he said. I'd like the roads in rural Lynn County to get more attention. I'd like the county to be more county-oriented instead of things that seem to be more national-based, climate change-type things. In November, Zumbach said one reason that made him want to run for supervisor was the issues surrounding a raise the supervisors took in early 2019, pushing the salary for the position over $115,000 a year, which Zumbach has previously said he thinks is too high. Previously, when board salaries initially went over the 6-figure mark, voters showed their anger by downsizing the board from 5 to 3 members in 2016. I do know that in 2.5 weeks on the job that I'm confident that when the board went from 5 to 3, that was one of the biggest mistakes Lynn County residents made, Zumbach said in mid-January. I think right now the number of supervisors is more important than the salary. I wouldn't have said that before. If he had it his way, Zumbach said he would tie the population to the position so each supervisor would represent 30 to 35,000 people, with a portion of those people being from Cedar Rapids and the other portion being from the smaller towns and rural areas. He said if that happened, he would want it tied to a pay scale that wouldn't rely on recommendations from a compensation board. I think that would give a better representation with less pet projects, Zumbach said. If you did that with 7 supervisors, it could be considered a part-time job. If the law were to change and go to 7, the salaries would no doubt come down because you're sharing the workload. I'm still advocating that we're very generously paid. It's service-oriented, and if you want to keep that, you wouldn't have to pay as much. Though Zumbach acknowledged that he and his Democratic colleagues on the board may have political differences, he said working with Rogers and Walker so far has been a great experience. While colleagues have been more than fair to me, he said, I do think that most of the time we want to get to the same place, just a different way. Supervisor Walker said that despite the political differences between him and Zumbach, he appreciates people who run for office and want to serve their community. He said he hopes Zumbach understands the differences of the Board of Supervisors and the Iowa legislature. Louis Zumbach is a good person. It hasn't quite yet become clear what he intends to focus on, and it's still early in his tenure, Walker told the Gazette. There is no caucus here. We're all in the same team that has to work to make Linn County better. Walker added Zumbach has made comments to the board as well as about the job of supervisor being part-time. I know there was a big push from his district to reduce from 3 to 5, and I know he's talked about wanting to add additional supervisors. So my hope is, before he rushes to judgment about the nature of this work, he will give it a little time, Walker said. Supervisor Rogers said that Zumbach's perspective as a farmer and former legislator will help the board look at issues with a different lens. When you meet Louis, you can tell he is genuine in his desire to find solutions to help people and solve problems. Rogers, who has served in the role since 2008, told the Gazette. He has asked a lot of great questions about the county, and as someone who was once new, I can attest there is a significant learning curve in learning about county government and the services we provide. Turning to a column entitled History Happenings by Joe Coffey, Dance Ban. In Cedar Rapids, the Charleston and Jitterbug were outlawed. Just as older generations tried to save American youth from the dangers of the Lambada and the Twist, even older generations were in tizzies over other dances. They feared the worst when young people did the Jitterbug, the Charleston, and the Grizzly Bear. The only difference is those older generations were successful in getting the dances banned in Iowa. A front-page article in the November 20, 1912 Evening Gazette told of the associations between suggestive dances and Chicago's Vice District. In a successful effort to shut down a seedy side of town, undercover Chicago police witnessed women doing exaggerated versions of the Grizzly Bear and the Bunny Hug. Ragtime music was all the rage, spawning dances like the Fish Walk, the Chicken Scratch, and the Horse Trot. By 1913, the Cedar Rapids City Council passed Ordinance 1019 banning the worst of the beastly jigs. Section 8 specified the prohibition of the Grizzly Bear, Bunny Hug, Turkey Trot, and the Texas Tommy. It also banned similar dances of questionable or indecent character. By the 1920s, hot jazz numbers blending Dixieland, ragtime, and brass band marches came with a dance that would exemplify the decade. Rooted in South Carolina's African-American culture and enhanced by a black Broadway show and Harlem dance halls, the Charleston was as carefree and spirited as the speakeasy vibes of the day. In 1925, a 4th of July rager was underway in Boston when a hall full of Charleston dancers collapsed, killing 44 people. The collapse probably was caused by an earlier fire, water damage, and an excavation next door, but cities across the country now had reason to ban the dance. In December, Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wes Benish and Building Inspector Otis Liefers decided they'd ban the Charleston and the Flea Hop within city limits via a safety edict. The city council followed up by adding the Charleston to the existing dance ban along with dances with similar steps. A champion Charleston dance duo that had already been booked for an exhibition in town was allowed to continue after performing a special demonstration for Benish and Liefers. A Gazette article on January 2, 1926 described the arrests of teenagers Robert Clark and Beulah Curtwright, who were charged with stealing a coat and a purse on New Year's Eve. As it turns out, Chief Benish had run into the pair earlier in the night and stopped them from doing the Charleston on a crowded dance floor. A follow-up front-page headline a few days later declared, "Dancing couple given chance to go straight." Miss Curtwright was placed under suspended commitment to the House of the Good Shepherd in Devonport, while Mr. Clark was given a choice between joining the Navy or remaining under supervision of the court. Young Cedar Rapidians were shredding rugs to the Jitterbug by 1938, fueled by a danceland booking of the King of Swing himself, Benny Goodman. Within a year, the Jitterbug was illegal. This time, the city's evolving dance ban ordinance was adjusted to specify the Jitterbug, the Big Apple, and the Shag, as well as similar dances causing undue vibrations to dance floors. The urgent ordinance included a penalty of up to $100 and 30 days in jail. Many cities have odd, outdated laws still in place simply because they were never repealed. That might be the case with Cedar Rapids' prohibition of certain dances. City Clerk Amy Stevenson's office is digitizing old city council meeting minutes from way back when, which will eventually make it easier to look up old, forgotten laws, but says they still have a way to go. As far as she can tell at this point, the Jitterbug, Big Apple, and the Shag might still be illegal, along with similar dances causing undue vibrations to dance floors. And because I have realized that I neglected to read the column from Todd Dorman today, 24-Hour Doorman, I turn back to that for my final entry today. Bill would put a fresh coat of whitewash on history. In the opening paragraphs of her Pulitzer Prize-winning essay commencing the New York Times 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah Jones describes how her father always flew a pristine American flag outside their home in Waterloo. Our corner lot, which had been redlined by the federal government, was along the river that divided the black side from the white side of our Iowa town. At the edge of our lawn, high on an aluminum pole, soared the flag, which my dad would replace as soon as it showed the slightest tatter, Hannah Jones wrote. Her father's family worked as sharecroppers in Jim Crow, Mississippi, where black Americans risked their safety just by living their daily lives. They came north hoping to escape danger and discrimination, but found, as Hannah Jones writes, Jim Crow did not end at the Mason-Dixon line. The family struggled. Her father joined the military and found crushing discrimination there, too. So after all that, Hannah Jones couldn't understand why her father flew that flag. How could he be patriotic after all he endured? Like most young people, I thought I understood so much when in fact I understood so little. My father knew exactly what he was doing when he raised that flag. He knew that our people's contributions to building the richest and most powerful nation in the world were indelible, that the United States simply would not exist without us, Hannah Jones wrote in her August 2019 essay. The ambitious 1619 Project places black Americans at the center of our American story while seeking to tell hard truths about the fundamental role slavery, shameful discrimination, and white supremacy have played in America's history. It scrubs the whitewash from our national narrative, boldly reframing the history of great white men we were taught in school. Not surprisingly, the project has been controversial. It's drawn both high praise and sharp criticism. Myth-busting tends to make us uncomfortable. It's certainly not the last word on American history, but it sparked important, difficult conversations, the kind you'd like to see in a classroom, especially now as racial injustice and systematic racism are front-burner issues in the United States. So naturally, an Iowa State lawmaker wants to ban the 1619 Project from Iowa classrooms. Representative Skylar Wheeler, R. Orange City, is the sponsor of House File 222, which bans schools, community colleges, and state universities from using any United States history curriculum that is in whole or in part derived from the 1619 Project. Institutions that do so lose a portion of their state funding. Wheeler's bill argues the project attempts to deny or obfuscate the fundamental principles on which the United States was founded. The measure seeks to promote an accurate account of this nation's history through public schools and forming young people into knowledgeable and patriotic citizens. Wheeler is apparently afraid that Iowa students might learn how much sustaining the institution of slavery motivated our nation's founders and how they shaped our republic, or how American Abraham Lincoln, who signed the Emancipation Proclamation, also favored efforts to convince freed blacks to leave the country, or how the promise of Reconstruction was smashed by white terrorism, creating a society where black Americans were treated as less than human to justify persecution. Instead of banishing these lessons from classrooms, we should aspire to face the unflinching truths of our history and learn its lessons. Look, we do have a history problem, but Republicans such as Wheeler really should start with the folks who wore Auschwitz t-shirts and carried Confederate battle flags into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, with hopes of capturing or even killing members of Congress. It's his party, steeped in conspiracy theories, that doesn't want to punish a historically reckless president who lit the fuse on an insurrection. What are the kids learning from that, Representative Wheeler? But to guys like Wheeler, the persecution of conservatives is the real problem. Wheeler recently voted in favor of a bill that would add political ideology to the protected classes covered by Iowa Civil Rights Code. And yet, here's Wheeler seeking to cancel the 1619 Project. The good news is politicians like Wheeler always fail at the suppression game. Great scholarship on our history is out there, and the kids will find it. And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 31st. 2021. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto. Remember, you can access a recording of this newspaper or other newspaper recordings on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time.